You need someone in to lead the team who knows what AI is, who knows what it isn't, who knows when you can use it and when you can't, how much it's going to cost you, how long it's going to take. And that person will create a roadmap that will show the way for that team as to what they are going to be doing, how they're going to need to develop, how they're going to need to bring external partners in, when they're going to need to bring external partners in, how they're going to take the organisation on a journey, and quite frankly, keep them interested.
I'd like to say a big thank you to our sponsors, Talent Insights. Talent Insights are Australia's leading specialist data recruitment business. With offices in Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane, their experts are providing recruitment strategy and building data teams for clients across industries Australia-wide. They provide recruitment solutions for all roles across the data lifecycle, including data engineering, data science, advanced analytics, customer and marketing insights, business intelligence, data product managers, and data governance. They're skilled at finding the best permanent and contract hires for your business needs, as well as statement of work, project focus, data resources. At Talent Insights, relationships matter most. I can say from first-hand experience, Talent Insights are fantastic to work with. Whether you're a business leader within an HR network or a specialist data candidate, Talent Insights should be the first company you turn to for all your data recruitment needs. Find them at talentinsights.com.au.
Data Futurology has three exciting conferences coming up in the second half of the year. So we have Data Engineering coming up on the 5th of September in Sydney, followed by Advancing AI in Sydney on the 6th and 7th of September. And then in end of October, October 24th and 25th, we're going to have our Ops World event in Melbourne. As usual, our conferences cover three main pillars, which one is executive perspectives on leadership and strategy in the space. The second one is industry use cases and case studies, where you can see how other people are applying the technologies or what they're doing, what type of innovations they're doing in their organizations that can help you. And then the third one is we review advancements in the technologies. What is the new tech stacks that we could be implementing? How are people switching from one type of platform to another? Come and find out what's happening in the community. Bring your teams along, get everyone together. It's gonna be three great events. Hope to see you there, thanks.
So to help us moderate this panel is Jonas Christensen. He's got a dual, wears two hats, multiple hats, but two here. He's the host of Leaders of Analytics podcast. I encourage you to listen. And he's also the head of data science at the legal firm Morris Blackburn & Rogers. Please welcome Jonas Christensen.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the next session. So we are going to be talking about the leadership required to actually enable AI in business. And we have three very distinguished data leaders here with us today. So first up, please welcome Dr. Christine Smart, who is the Chief Strategy Officer at Defence Health. Nanda Neil-Meister, who is the Chief Data Analytics Officer at RMIT. And lastly, Dr. Michelle Joy, who is Head of Data and AI at Reese Group. Thank you all three for joining this panel today. And this is a really, really interesting and also very important topic, because at the end of the day, nothing happens without leadership. And The way I think about what we collectively have to do is basically combine three building blocks, which is we have some raw material, we have some data, then we have the ability to produce something with that data, but we also need to have in an organization the ability to consume what is produced. And all three have to be of high quality for us to succeed with AI. With that in mind, there are lots of components underneath that, such as culture, strategy, the way we collaborate, the people we have in the organization, et cetera, et cetera, and also our individual capabilities as those leaders. So those are the things that we're going to be touching on shortly. And now, I might start with you and start with the topic of culture. How do data leaders foster a culture of being able to consume AI in the organization and what's required to do that?
This is a really big question, and I'm sure whatever I'll say, the other panel members will add to it. I think the role of data leaders is to unlock the potential for AI to make a difference. If it's a commercial organization, it's usually about cost and efficiency and being competitive. In the case of university, what we're trying to do is to improve the lives of our students and staff through trusted insights. This is the vision of our data strategy. And when I'm thinking about the cultural components and what our role in it is, I'm very excited. I think we live in a very amazing age of AI, generative AI coming into our space. It's just the right place to be the data leader. But for data leader to succeed, we need to build really good cooperation with every part of our organization. In our case, we have more than 80 data stewards that work with us to improve data quality, to be our champions in the business. We also build really good cross-functional teams with our technology counterparts. So it doesn't really matter whether you report to technology or to DNA, we work together to produce the outcomes. The other really big cultural element, I think, is and the role that we have to perform is to build trust in AI. And that comes from, first of all, like transparency, that we use for our AI questions. We need to understand whether we have sensitive data, privately identifiable information in our models. We need to be transparent about biases and how we address biases and be able to answer these questions if people will ask. That builds trust. But also trust comes together with the fear as well. And a fear is attached to misunderstanding of what AI will do. There are still people that think that AI will completely replace their jobs. And you know what? In some instances, it probably will. But according to the World Economic Forum, by 2025, 85 million jobs will be replaced, but 97 million jobs will be created. And so where I see our role is developing is in increasing data literacy within our companies. At RMIT, we do a lot of that because we believe that the more we teach people the basics of AI, the least they will be fearful of AI and its implementation. And probably the last thing that I want to say is we also need to build resilience within our organizations because the change is very rapid in AI space, and especially now with generative AI, when 200 new apps appear in a week. That rapid change needs to be assessed, it needs to be understood, and we have a big role to play in that. So that's probably, I only touched on some components of it. There is definitely more innovation. At RMIT, we give people an opportunity one day every fortnight to work on innovation, on process improvement, and not work on sort of their projects. And out of that one day, we already see a huge benefit to people because they experiment, they come up with new ideas, and we can implement these ideas into practice.
So is that within your function or is that across the organization?
No, it's within my function, but we basically serve most of the portfolios and colleges with some analytic staff within the colleges working with us.
Got it. So there was a very great comment for starting a conversation because there was so much in that. And I should say that we have Slido happening as well. So if you do have questions for the panel, please go to Slido and the QR code is on the table there. Go to Slido and put your questions up and we'll embed them in the conversation. Now there was a lot of stuff in that comment, and I might pick up on one particular topic there, Michelle, which Nana mentioned, which is collaboration, because as leaders, we really have this inherent responsibility to kind of string together right from what we heard earlier. We should start with the end in mind, and we should start with the business case first. So from that business case, all the way back to through more and more technical implementation to the raw material, which is data. So how do leaders foster that collaboration across that value chain? What are some of your tips there?
Points. An example of what's my back?
Well, that's a very loaded question. When you think about these complex topics, I like thinking about industries that do that well, that might not necessarily be data. And for me, top of mind, I've just become an aunt recently, and so top of mind is the hospital system. And I was told that in the room where, you know, my little niece was born, there were all sorts of professionals, the gynecologists and the nurses and the midwives, and they're all, very looking after a very specific function, but there to do the same thing, which is to bring the child into the world. And when you think about what is the common denominator, the job done, one of the key elements is that they speak a common language. And so I think when we bring that back into the data context, and certainly at Race where I work, we're a bimove cell trade business. We have everybody who's interested in merchandising to trade sales, and I run the team that provides data and products to those teams making decisions about how best to serve our customers. At the end of the day, what's been really important has been to find a common vernacular for describing value. In any initiative, from the business side of it, we've had to really find ways to articulate across functions what value looks like. From a product management perspective, you'd be talking about value in terms of what our customers need and what the uplift is or what the size of margin is that you're looking to realize. That's a very different audience to talk to when you're talking about the engineering capability that's needed to deliver against that. And you might be weighing up trade-offs against, which corners to cut or what features to build in the product, but that still needs to be mapped back to a common basis on value. So for us, a lot of the work has gone into developing communication structures and accountability structures that would allow all teams in that mix to be able to speak to their components of delivering value. And quite frankly, that still is a work in progress as the business grows. I don't think that's ever complete work, but it's a discipline that we've had to roll into everything from our executive communications to, team-based working rhythms.
So if I paraphrase what you're saying, you can correct me if I'm wrong. It's partly about finding a common denominator, a common goal, a common way of communicating between different teams, but also those teams. So you talked about product management or data engineering, what have you. Talking about their addition to that same solution and taking ownership of it thereby. Is that fair?
Yeah, succinctly, yes.
Okay. I can see we're getting lots of questions, which is great. So keep them coming, and you can also upload questions that you would like to hear the answer to first and foremost. So Please do go and engage with Slido. Christine, another topic that Nona mentioned from the outset there was the role that the talent plays in this, because there's a lot of technology in this, but at the end of the day, it starts with the humans and the people we have for building these systems and leading them and so on. How do we develop and retain the skill sets in our organizations to do this job really well, especially in a time where things are evolving so rapidly that it can be maybe a little bit overwhelming with the amount of knowledge and skill you have to build?
Absolutely. So I think in terms of developing and attracting and retaining talent, there's obviously hygiene factors that you need to get right? Like you need to get salaries right, you need to get self-development right, you need to get your infrastructure right so that people can come and do their jobs. But they're all hygiene factors. In terms of really developing and steering the ship through, and to touch on the point, Nona, you made, it comes down to leadership. And I know there are people in this audience who know me well and know that I'm not really a fluffy sort of person, and they're probably thinking, leadership, what is she talking about? But allow me to elaborate a little bit more. Leadership matters, right? It doesn't matter if you're in HR, it doesn't matter if you're in a call center, it doesn't matter if you're in sales or if you're in AI. You come to work each day and you come to work for a manager, and who that person is drives a lot of your development, drives a lot of your intent to stay. I think that leaders need to know how to motivate people, right? That's their job. And, you know, what motivates someone's in sales is different to what motivates someone in a call center, motivates someone in HR, and what motivates people in AI is different, right? We're a unique group of people. And I say that with the all the love in my heart, right? So I think that you need to have someone who really does know how to motivate that team. And the key to motivation is the pipeline or the work they're doing and the pipeline of work that they have coming in, right? This talent pool really wants to know that what they're doing is interesting, that it's driving business outcomes, that it's relevant, and that it's complex. If it's not hitting on those topics, then quite frankly, your talent will leave. And some of the ways in which we don't end up with a good pipeline of work or program of work or initiatives or whatever you want to call it some of the ways we end up with that is we appoint the wrong leaders. And, you know, we're all responsible in this room for appointing leaders and for holding ourselves accountable. So, you know, sometimes I'm sure we've all been in a business and where we've had to report into, or we know someone like, and I'll just pick a name and hopefully there's no one, Paul, and Paul's from payroll. Apologies if there's a Paul from payroll. I'll buy you a free coffee at lunch. But Paul from payroll has been appointed to head the AI team because Paul from payroll is really good with numbers. He knows the systems and he knows the business. Now, Paul from payroll is going to end up with a terrible roadmap of initiatives, right? Because Paul doesn't understand AI. He doesn't know when you can use it, when you can't. He doesn't know what the risks are, so he can't go in there and really drive a conversation at the initial points of, hey, we shouldn't be doing this. He doesn't know how long it's going to take. He doesn't know how much it's going to cost. So he's going to go to all these meetings and he's going to come back to his team with a roadmap of ideas that are completely unsuitable. Quite frankly, they're probably not even going to be AI, and they're going to be unfunded. Paul's not the leader that you need in that team, right? That's not to say that you need to put your best machine learning engineer in to run the team either, right? That's also fraught with a bit of peril. You need someone in to lead the team who knows what AI is, who knows what it isn't, right? Who knows when you can use it and when you can't, how much it's going to cost you, you know, all I said before, how long it's going to take. And that person will create a roadmap that will show the way for that team as to what they are going to be doing, how they're going to need to develop, how they're going to need to bring external partners in, when they're going to need to bring external partners in, how they're going to take the organisation on a journey, and quite frankly, keep them interested. Because if your talent isn't interested in what you're doing, then they will leave. So a bit of a, a, if you've got a strong constitution, go back to your teams this afternoon or tomorrow, whenever you get a chance, and ask them if they're interested in what they're doing. Do they think it's driving business outcomes? And do they think it's complex? And if one of them says no, then probably mark that person as a flight risk. If all of them say no, then you've got a big problem. You may be the problem. But you've got to look at how you're going to create momentum in your team. So that's a long-winded answer, perhaps.
Can I just add to it? I'm probably one of those leaders that don't have a background in AI. My background is in data, but I do have very clever people that can help me to develop that roadmap, and I rely on these people to help me. But in my mind, the most important thing is treat your team as a family. Mm. Like, this is your working family. And we do a lot of that. We celebrate birthdays together. We celebrate any important events in people's lives. We create this atmosphere where people really would love to be. Not only we're giving them the tools that they need to do their job, but not only we're sort of trying to create processes that as less bureaucratic and as more innovative as possible, we also train people and they learn from each other. We give them that opportunity to learn from each other. And we also provide them with very flexible working arrangements. Like in data and AI, there are a lot of people that are introverts. They don't need to be in the office every day. Some do, and they absolutely come, but we provide full flexibility. And that works for people. And we had last year was a real roller coaster because people were leaving, the data analytics platform was not fully developed, and we lost quite a lot of stuff. Everyone else did as well, I know. But people are started coming back. They worked somewhere else, and they're saying, well, you know what, culture is what's important. And that family culture that we're creating is what people coming back for.
I think that the leader drives the culture there, right? So it comes back to leadership.
Yeah, leadership matters. Absolutely. Yeah, I agree.
Leadership does matter. I personally often reflect on the fact that my favorite job that I've ever had and the worst job I've ever had was actually the same job, but the only difference was the person I was reporting to. So that says a lot about that, and I try to use that in my own approach to leading. How do I create that environment where it is someone's favorite job because of the way that we operate as a team? Now, a question for all three of you, so please jump over each other to answer it. One thing that I'm reflecting on here as I talk to the three of you is there is what we're trying to do with the team, we're trying to foster a culture, but there's also something in us that we have to foster and enable. So I consider the role of data and analytics leadership somewhat unique because it's necessarily that we are inventing our own industry as we go. You said, Nana, I don't come from a background in AI. I think very few people come from a background in AI because it's actually very new. So how are you going to be establishing a background at that time? Some people are, but they're rare. So we're kind of inventing the world as we go. And we're also selling this skill set and the function and the ability for it to be used to execute strategy as opposed to a more esoteric skill or sort of interesting PowerPoint packs and insights to something more of a strategic driver. But that requires something different of that kind of leader. Could you talk about each of you? We might start with you, Michelle. What are the specific traits that we necessarily must foster in ourselves to be able to do this well?
Such
big question. It's like, you ask all difficult ones. Look, I think, you know, everyone's journey has been quite different, and the discipline of data and AI is also quite unique in that it doesn't fit into any one box, right? So, you know, it's not a pure tech play. It's not a pure business play either. It's really at the intersect of many disciplines, and then that's how you run into many professionals that come into this industry through many different pathways. And I think the key thing that I've learned in, you know, building a team at Race was recognizing that that is part of the secret sauce, and that when you're building a team and leading people through careers in this industry, that it's not fully formed and not all the answers are there about what a verified way to thrive in this environment is. So for us, it was more around the principles of leading a team and what it looks like for the roles these folks are in at this point in time, as well as where that can go, and creating those ladders and pathways that are not just designed for what the organization needs, because that's important, and it's important to have the organizational strategy in mind. But the other side of it is designing roles that people want and being able to help people grow through that. And so what that's looked like and changed over time, I think for me, the learning has been, how do I adapt to our environment and be constantly fostering a discipline of helping shape the team and meet its needs and align that with, you know, where our organization is going, and keep that as a constant discipline as opposed to being a one and done soul and leading the team and kind of pushing them through a path. So that's been top of mind and continues to be as we grow our practice.
I think probably the most important quality of a leader that I value is listening to your people. What worked for us multiple times is I actually have one-on-ones with every single person in my team. Doesn't matter if they report to somebody who reports to me. I want to know what people think and what kind of issues do they have. And as a result of these meetings, we could fix little things that were really annoying, but people were really thankful for that. So to me, that's, if I can think about one thing, go to Gemba, you know, talk to your people, understand what barriers you as a leader can remove for them to make their life easier.
I'd echo what you both said, but I think I'd also add one thing that we could all do, and I found incredibly helpful, was to go and invest, if you want to do a bit of self-development, go and invest in a course in change management, because I think I didn't even realise it was a real thing, to be honest with you, but it turns out change management is a real thing, and we are at a point where we're leading teams in and developing AI as we go, and what are the rules and the state of play. There's a lot of ambiguity, and leading not only your team but leading an organisation through change and to creating a culture requires a really strong capability of change management and understanding people and people's emotional reactions to oh, we're going to put in a chatbot to answer all of customer inquiries by the end of the year. And just because we're excited about technology doesn't mean that everyone else will be. So I can't underestimate the importance of having really solid change management skills in your toolkit too.
Thank you, all three. Let's take some questions from Slido. So the most upvoted question so far is, how do you increase data literacy across an organization without risking people self-serving the wrong answers? Does anyone care to jump on that one?
Without what, sorry?
Without self-serving the wrong answers. So I suppose you're giving data to the masses, you're giving people information. So say dashboards, reporting, business intelligence, perhaps other tools where you can access information, and everyone's all of a sudden an analyst by default. How do you control the risk that they're going to come up with the wrong things, basically?
I'll give this one a crack because we are on that journey. And it's a really tough balance to make because you always want there to be interest to use data for better decisioning. And in our team, we've been working on a framework to share with our business partners around decision-making with data. And the wrong answers is kind of one aspect of that framework. There are two angles that we look at. One is baking checks and balances into those decision-making processes as a discipline is important. And, you know, sharing some practical examples within each business area is important. So, you know, we work with finance who might be doing some forecasting around collections, how you think of what's wrong and right in, you know, using that data is quite different to how you might be using a model for predicting supply chain stock movement and what that means for deliveries. And so having checks and balances in place and how do you apply that to your decision-making processes, that's part of what we've been working with teams on. The second angle, though, is the concept of wrong itself. And more importantly, what the impact of wrong actually is. Again, there's some asymmetry there depending on what area you're applying that data to. So, you know, it's for us, you know, we work with all teams in the business. So from time to time, we might be doing marketing analytics and predicting customer segments and things like that. The impact of getting a customer segment wrong and targeting them wrong is quite different to how you might, you know, apply, say, machine learning to product recommendation in e-commerce. And the impact there is sized up quite differently. So the second part of how we've been thinking about handling the wrong answers is think about the size of that and what the real impact of that is. And does it afford you the luxury of taking a bit more risk and in that process learning from it? Or do you have, you know, more constraints to work with? So that's the journey we've been on so far.
I'll sort of answer it from slightly different perspective. The wrong answer sometimes come when people don't understand definitions that went into the development of a data dashboard or model or anything like that. So we actually very heavily invested in working together as a university, as a business community, to define key university terms. We have now about 300 terms clearly defined, not just defined in words, but also defined in terms of what's included in that definition and what's excluded from that definition. So when somebody in marketing looks at the dashboards, that a dashboard that talks about student attrition, they know exactly what these numbers mean. And to me, that it's a lot of work, and we put people from different parts of the organization together to work through that. But as a result, we have less and less these discussions about which numbers are wrong and which numbers are right.
Great. Christina, I'm asking you to finish us off today with this the last question. How do you get executive buy-in when outcomes aren't guaranteed, often unknown, and in many cases ridiculous?
I was watching the countdown. I was just hoping that we'd end up before you passed me to answer this question. Unfortunately not. I think that executive buy-in comes with executive understanding. So you need to really have advocates. You need to be able to explain to the executives what you're trying to achieve, what the benefits will be, and you need to just keep chipping away at your elevator speeches so that when you do have 15 seconds with your ELT, you are able to articulate really clearly what you're hoping to achieve. I think the other piece that I'd go, and I think it was said before, and I don't know, Felipe, if it's yourself or someone else, but start small, right? Don't try and get your executive to buy in on a six-year project that may or may not have success. You know, like sitting on an executive now, there's no way it's going to happen, right? Start with a small win. Start with something that shows how you're going to add value. And then I think it sort of follows from there.
Thank you. We are out of time for today. So thank you all three for your wonderful contribution to our thought process in how we become better data leaders. Now, if you are interested in learning more from these three, they will be out here. You can bother them during coffee breaks and so on. I'm sure that's allowed. Other than that, Felipe will hand back to you to take us through the next session.
That brings this episode to conclusion. Thank you so much for listening. Please find us on datafuturology.com or on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, or Instagram as datafuturology. Also go to datafuturology.com/podcast to find the show notes for this and any other episodes. If you like this episode, it would mean a lot to us if you could leave us a review wherever you listen to our podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode and that it was helpful and valuable for you. Thanks again, and see you next time.